Welcome to the Truth to Power Show Radio for Brooklyn. I'm your host, VGR Nathan. I'm here with co-host Douglas Kala. Welcome, Douglas.
How you doing? Great. I'm here. Yeah.
So, you know, recent news, you know, O.J. Simpson just died, which may be relevant to this conversation since we're going back. We're taking the time word back to the 80s and 90s with Robert Kaplan's book, Past, Present. And I'll introduce it in 1 second. But interesting how the 90s seem to be a throwback to the 90s. Bring us all back. How are you doing, Doug?
Good, doing well. Yeah.
Yeah. So our guest is Robert Kaplan. Robert Kaplan, the author of Past, Present, and Other Poems, published in September 2023 by Poets Queens Press. He has an MFA in creative writing from University of Arizona and has a PhD in early American literature from CUNY Graduate Center and teaches expository writing at Stony Brook University. His poetry has recently appeared in KGB Lit magazine and is forthcoming in summer 2024 in the second Poets of Queens anthology. In a former life, his work has been published in numerous and small literary magazines that no longer exist. That's funny, yeah. He stopped writing for many years. First, he would combine overload of full-time elder care and doctoral studies and the fundamental care and teaching. But now he's currently working on two poetry manuscripts, one collection of unfinished and finished older and newer poems, and the other a book-length poem about being an elder caregiver. Welcome, Robert.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Wow. Great, great. So as I was saying about the revisiting the past, you know, with your poems and looking backwards, looking at the how it lives on and how it can teach us something, I guess, or show us something, some insight. But I'm curious about what your thoughts are about revisiting the past.
Well, I think it's William Faulkner who says the past is never really past.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, rereading the poems, it's kind of scary to me in certain ways how little has changed. I mean, like, it's like, I remember when I was in college, which was in the mid 70s, so that's how far back we've gone. There was when Esso became Exxon and Nixon was president, there was a big poster that with the White House that said Nixon. It was spelled with two X's, N-I-X-X-O-N. And underneath it said the name's been changed, but it's the same old gas. And that's sort of what it feels like in certain ways. Like I was rereading the poems, especially Diane talking about the mid 80s and Reagan as president and just like the very beginning of the AIDS epidemic and stuff like that. And the politics, the names have changed and some things have changed in certain ways, but in other ways it still feels like it's 30 years later and it's very much the same script.
And sometimes in some places the dynasties haven't changed that much, you know, from the 80s and 90s, you know, Clinton living on for many years, and then now Biden being a throwback to the, you know, just 20 years ago or whatever. So again, these persistencies of names, persistence of dynasties and names seems to be interesting. And Trump also being someone who was a big figure back in the day as well, but in different context, you know?
Yeah. And it's not just the names. It's like the right wing politics back then, like the right wing politics now are a more extreme version of the right wing politics back then.
Good point. Yeah.
But it's still real. Yeah. I mean, like Reagan would be completely disavowed by the MAGAs at this point. But it's like the moral majority to pick your pick, you know, today there's just so many, but it's just like a heightened version of the same to me.
So one thing I want to ask you is why poetry to give your message or give your talk about? As I was reading Past, Present, I was wondering whether or not what your attraction to poetry is and why you chose to deliver these poems as such rather than like a novel, you know?
Well, in a former life, since we're talking about former life, I did used to actually write a lot of prose. And I'm not sure exactly. At that point, I was doing both prose and poetry. And I'm not sure exactly when I stopped doing prose. Maybe getting a PhD and writing a dissertation sort of like killed that part of me for a long time. But there's something for me that just resonates with poetry. And I have nothing like I'm rereading Victorian novels at the moment. So I mean, I love prose. But in terms of writing it, I mean, it's interesting that you would ask why not a novel out of this period of time. And I think when I like, I mean, it's an interesting question. And I think A, I'm not quite sure I have enough material for a novel. And B, it's like there are clear, I mean, I hope it's clear there are all these threads that come through. But they all have their very distinct moments and pieces and places. And I think poetry captures that better
No,
because
definitely, definitely. It felt like a little more mosaic, it felt like. And it felt very beautiful. And the language, of course, is very beautiful. There's some gems in there that wouldn't be translated as well in prose. But I just wanted to throw that question just for the sake of, of curiosity. But yeah, and then also, what were the influences on you that influenced you, what writers influenced you and brought you to the place where you mentioned a little bit of your influences, but
Well, people ask me that question on a regular basis, and at this point, the sad truth of it is that I'm not really reading much poetry. But I just sort of sit down and it comes out. But in my more formative years, where it was when I was still developing the craft, I mean, one always is developing the craft, but I like to think and hope that my craft is a little bit more developed now than it was in the mid '80s, say. So, I mean, clearly Whitman. Everyone can see like Whitman in here, and Ginsberg too. Like poets that work with, I mean, obviously I work a lot with images, but I also work a lot with just sort of the rhythm of language, or at least I try to work with the rhythm of language. And it might be because I took piano lessons for 10 years or something like that. So poets who, it's not even necessarily the long poem genre, although obviously past present is quite a long poem. But poets who just kind of like the cascade effect of language. Whitman's really great with that, and Ginsberg is really great with that. There was a period of time that I would say is a sort of prior iteration of some of the earlier poems here, where Sharon Olds was actually a really big influence on my work. It's sort of like she gave me, reading her work gave me permission to write about certain things that I had wanted to write about and hadn't felt like I could. And so that was really useful for me. And Adrienne Rich, even though her, like on the surface, her work and mine are really, really different, I think some of the sort of deeper questions that she's dealing with in her poetry really resonate with me in terms of my own work a lot.
That's great. That's great. And I just want to give a shout out to the Poets of Queens Press. Of course, you live in New York, and but you've been all around the country, and you make references to different places around the world and the global aspects to it. I liked. If you talk a little bit about where you consider yourself your home to be, a little bit around that, a little bit of home around, or if you consider any place particularly, like, do you consider yourself now a New Yorker, or what do you think about that?
Well, what's unintentionally funny and ironic about that question is I am now, and I have been now for some time, living. I grew up in New York. I grew up. We moved. We. I grew, I was born in Forest Hills, which I don't remember. And then when I was 1 year old, we moved to Fresh Meadows, and when I was 5, we moved to Flushing. And I am living in the house that in Flushing that we moved to when I was 5 years old. I have obviously not lived here my whole life. I mean, now I love New York, and I can't imagine living anywhere else. But growing up, and I mean, like my teens and 20s and stuff, I sort of had this love-hate relationship with New York. So when I was in high school, I really wanted to get out of New York City. I wanted to go to a small school on the, like, I was happy among like pigs and cows and shit and woods. And just a small college out in the middle of nowhere. And then I moved to Boston after I graduated, and I lived there for 5 years. And at that point, that was the late 70s, up for like 76 to 81. And it was, you know, it was an incredible period of time because there was still a counterculture at that point. And it was incredible. It wasn't like the 60s. So when people talk about the 70s as being like the me decade or something, and I just don't, I mean, there's elements of that, but what I knew of the 70s, there was still this incredible countercultural and alternative politics and political movements and stuff going on. I mean, and that's when, you know, like the gay liberation movement, the women's lib movement, all those things came into their own. And that's when I discovered punk. And I went from being a hippie to a punk rocker, and decided in 81 that it was time to move back to New York, because being a gay punk rocker in Boston had real limitations. And so I lived in Manhattan for 7 years, and I had a great, like, I was writing a lot of poetry, to come back to your earlier question. I also wrote a novella that's sitting in a file cabinet somewhere. And you know, it was a completely different era because, like, for example, when I moved to Boston, I lived in Cambridge. I lived in a group house, and this was 1976, and I was paying $74 a month in rent. And those things don't exist. And when I moved to New York in '81, I was paying $360 a month for 4 rooms, and that gave me time to just work part time and write and paint and do political work and just sort of have a life. And it's like that doesn't exist. That whole world doesn't exist anymore, because teaching at the college level, I see my students, they're all in debt and they're all stressed out about their future, and they all just like don't feel like they can relax. And I feel really fortunate that I had that time to explore. But then New York felt like it was closing in on me, and I decided to go to Tucson to apply to graduate school for an MFA, and move to University of Arizona, to long-windedly answer your question. Yeah.
So,
Did you when you were in New York at that time, did you encounter any luminaries from that period? Like any, you know, like any activists, and did you work with them or anything like that?
well, you know, I was really on the periphery. I mean, I was just a little. The first couple of years, like the first couple of years getting anywhere, it's just sort of getting settled and stuff like that. And that was when the pyramid first was opening, and I met a lot of people there. So I wouldn't call him a luminary, but one of the poems in the book is called Avenue E, and it's about this magazine, Avenue E, that this very good, that is someone I met at the pyramid, who I became very good friends with, was putting out with some other people of that time period. And he and I put out a couple of issues together, and so the poem is really about the magazine and about that whole period of time. So unfortunately, I was a nobody, but
It's good to we'll put a pin in that because I would like to get a quick reading of one poem when we get a chance in a few minutes, but just build up a little bit. But also to tell the readers a little bit more about the book Past Present, which is the most recent book, I believe. So tell a bit more about that, a little bit more about the identity markers that your identity intersectionality or anything that they need to know about the book. A little bit more about that, a little bit more about kind of what's informing the book, you know?
So what's informing the book is when Olena asked me, told me that she wanted to publish a book of mine, and I've gone through so many different lives since this period of time, and like I said in, you know, my bio, I'm working, so I have like ended up doing like 20 years of elder care, and I'm writing two different books about that. But all those pieces are completely unfinished. So when Olena asked me, did I have enough for a book? I went back to sort of a file folder that I hadn't opened in a long period of time, because I really stopped writing poetry for about 20 years there. And going back, I was like, whoa, I did a lot more than I remember doing. And it's talking in terms of like intersectionality. I mean, obviously, a large part. So the 80s for me very much so was about being gay and about, being, I hate the term punk rocker, but that's what I was at 28, and living down in the Lower East Side or the East Village, whatever one was calling it back then, and just sort of living life. And it wasn't until I moved to Tucson where suddenly I felt like I was in Blonde Land. It's not like I was the only Jew there, but being a New York Jew and being a Southwest Jew are two very, very, very different things. So it really hit me with the first Gulf War. So my mom was born in Germany. And she was 9 years old when the Nazis came into power, and they were lucky. They were able to get out eventually because they had money. And there were a lot of people who wanted to get out who couldn't because they didn't. But it really hit me one day during the first Gulf War, when everyone was tying yellow ribbons around like everything. And I was on my bicycle biking to the university, and I was like biking down the sea of yellow ribbons. And it just felt so creepy on so many different levels. I mean, not just being against the war, but just like the yellow symbolism just felt so much to me like two shades away from yellow stars. And so it's become much more. I'm a bad Jew in many ways, and I'm certainly like the walking definition of a secular one, but it really kind of hit home. So having both those pieces of my identity, they don't really quite come together, but in certain ways they really do.
Yeah, I think so. And how the relevant issues, how we talk a little bit on the show, how the personal is political, and how the politicization of these issues, and how the different touchstones to the AIDS epidemic, for example, or things like that, gets touched on in the book, and theme in the book, and like how those politicized issues at that time period were like intersect, the whole world gets involved,
Totally, totally, yeah. And what I would say, everyone takes different lessons away from similar experiences, and it's always fascinating to me in a certain way how that happens. But for me, like hearing my mom talk about what it was like living under the Nazis. So I remember very clearly when Reagan was, this was like 85, mid-80s, and things were, I mean, now it just seems like things were fine, but back then it was a scary period of time. And she was talking about how it felt to her, what that it was like for her being in Germany in the early 30s, just before the Nazis came to power, because she was already 8, 9 years old, so she was like cognizant enough. What I took away from that whole, I mean, there's some people obviously who take away from that whole experience, this never again thing, which I'll just say drives me crazy. But for me, what I took away from that, which is really different, which is this is what happens when people stereotype each other. This is what happens when people turn someone into the other. And like the whole point of progressive politics is to try to break out of that otherness and see people as people and not as something to be pitted against.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And the otherness, and otherizing, and the scapegoating, it's someone's fault. Who's gonna, who's gonna be the other, who's gonna take that fall or whatever it is?
Exactly.
Yeah, the
Exactly.
need for that, yeah. So, what do you feel like? You feel like reading a poem? Like, why don't we read one and we can get into it, and then we can chat about it a little deeper. Yeah.
Do you have any suggestions about which
It's
one?
Avenue East, as we mentioned it. I like the E
Okay.
thing as well. I like to play on the E later in the poem, so we
Okay.
can do that one. Yeah.
Just to warn the audience, it's a little bit, it's not as long as the opening poem, but it's a good 5 minute poem. So,
All right, cool.
Avenue E. Avenue E is not an avenue on the island of Manhattan, and the insistent lick of the East River or the East River Drive can't ever make it one. On the far side of that river, a real Avenue E exists, but that meant Brooklyn, and we never went there, Stephen, because for us, Manhattan was the point of all those years. Not the Empire State Building or the Chrysler Building, but out on the edges, where those crumbling restaurants served borscht bialys in a window seat and were always the first stop of the night. The beets dunked in red liquid, the waiter smiling, the background hiss of cigarettes and voices, and everyone dressed with a particular purpose. Walking down the street with a warm stomach past bookstores and clothing shops, cars, trucks, and taxis honking and bouncing, and the smiles and the looks at the stopping to chat. Walking through those moldy doors into the kiss of a drag queen and Lou Reed singing about fishnets, lipstick, long earrings on the boys, black pumps on the girls, wandering from one tiny room back into the other, nodding at familiar faces, drinking scotch, and eyeing the bartender when Daniel, who had cruised for 6 months, slipped up behind me and cooed over the music that he was putting you in my safe keeping, then slipped away. 4 months later, we were at your apartment, drunk, killing roaches with our cigarettes. You went out for a carton, and Daniel sat on my lap and began kissing me. I don't know if it was the alcohol or the fact that we were finally actually doing it, but we kept bursting out laughing, and then we just couldn't stop. Daniel leaned his head on my shoulder, I leaned mine on his, and we shook and laughed and kissed each other's necks until we heard footsteps that could only be yours on the landing below. When you opened the door, he was in the kitchen washing dishes, and I was in the living room changing the record. It was Marianne Faithfull. She was singing broken English, and we screamed the words out at each other while Daniel swayed back and forth between us. Then he kissed you full on the lips. You put your arms around him and me. I put mine around the two of you. And I don't remember how long we stayed like that or who it was that moved first. But I do remember that when I closed the street door and stood on the sidewalk, the sky was gray and turning over me, and the streets were flicking slowly open, empty, and a little more promising. One night, you and I were at my apartment talking about the band we had just seen. You told me you had had an affair with the drummer, then leaned over the coffee table and said you wondered if people now thought we were having one because we always left in each other's company. This was long after you had shown me the first issue of Avenue E, told me how you and three friends had stayed up for a week to get it just right. E was energy. E was ecstasy. E was excitement. E was for everyone. E was poems and stories and cutout figures and individually colored drawings all enclosed in a large plastic bag. Each E had different sayings from tea bags and fortune cookies. Each E had its own special tarot card, its own unique E surprise. Now you said you wanted to do another issue and you wanted me to do it with you. Of course, I said yes. E would put me in print. E would make me famous. E would get me, like you, into all the clubs for free. This was 1982. I was going to be a writer or a rock star. You and Daniel had just moved in together. Lots of people were jealous. The pyramid was still ours. I would leave work at midnight and we would meet at the bar. You would turn away from whoever you were talking to, put your hand on my leg, and we would plot how E was going to change the world. E would defeat Reagan. E would expose the military-industrial complex. E would bring visual art and writing together. It was the vision of E, true egalitarianism. Eventually, the man you had been talking to would tap you on the shoulder, and the three of us would raise our vodkas and toast the new E era. Sometimes I'd go home with him, and sometimes I wouldn't. Everyone knew about Avenue E, and everyone said they wanted to help. We got pictures of abortions and babies and poems about families that went nowhere. You found a fake proclamation from Mayor Koch saying that no man could be out on the street after dark unless accompanied by a woman. We collected ads from galleries. We went to poetry readings. Your neighbor said he would draw the cover. That night, we were so happy we drank more than usual and hugged in your hallway for a long, long time. Sometimes I would watch you in your leather jacket, gesturing and smoking a cigarette. Daniel would be off in a corner talking to someone. People would stop and say hi and sneak you a feel. You would introduce me, and they would ask if we were cousins because we both had curly hair and talked with our hands. We talked to each other every day. We solicited more artwork. One night we laid everything out and realized we had 42 pages and money for 30. We called every temp agency we knew and took every job offered. Every Sunday, I figured out how much we had and how much we still needed. You'd order takeout Chinese and say you didn't know how you'd manage without me. I'd say you'd do just fine. It would just take a bit longer. Daniel would call or come by, and you would coo at each other. I'd turn on my calculator and pretend not to notice. People began coming up to me in bars instead of pretending we hadn't met four times already. Sometimes they'd pull me into the bathroom when they went to do drugs. When it was finally finished, we had a big party, and everyone danced and drank and wrote on a wall every word they could think of that began with E. It was the 80s. E's were everywhere. We made up E poems, gave away E prizes. Daniel created E cocktails, and we drank them extremely efficiently. I remember walking around handing out crayons for people to write with, putting my arms around you, then making out with someone who was now dead. Even now, I can see him walking up to me, saying something extravagant about how I looked holding a cocktail and crayons, taking the red one I extended, and when I smiled, touching my wrist with his thumb and laughing, pulling me into a chair, his green earring shining, his hand stroking my cheeks, his lips around mine soft and wet. This is the only way I know, Stephen, that will bring him, you, Daniel, everyone back.
Bravo, bravo. Thank you so much.
Nice. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was great. I just want to say it's so nice to hear a poet read like almost natural voice, like, because a lot of times these poet voice has been something I know a lot of people joke about or say about, but it can be hard
Like
to
the slam voice.
it's a,
Slam
like a
voice.
slam voice.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
Oh.
I'm glad to hear you almost in a natural voice, pretty much a natural voice. I'm able to understand flow with what
Great.
you mean. This is perhaps my own, like, problem, but I understand you clearly, and I think it's very, very well communicated. And I love that
Oh,
about,
thank you. Yeah.
yeah, because I can,
I don't do slam.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, it's good, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting. That E, just at the birth of the internet, we had Evites, we had E, a lot of E coming up, and now it's like more I, with the iPhone and the, it's interesting how you see me going through the vowels with the different understanding we have of
That's
the
true. Yeah.
culture. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good point. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
But yeah, and Doug, you have anything else you want to say about the poem, or you want to invite you
Yeah,
to
it was very, very, very descriptive, very visual, you know? Like I got
yeah.
like all the little, like all the scenes you described. Like I could actually like envision myself being there, you know?
Yeah, it creates certain intimacy with the reader, with the you, with the direct address. Really beautiful. I found that with all
Yeah,
your
like your point of view was very clear,
yeah.
you know?
It writes certain intimacy with the reader. You feel very like thrown into the middle of the action, and like all this different stuff going on, and We feel very much
There's very like observational, like fly on the wall kind of writing, you know?
yeah.
But you know, it's interesting. That was so this poem I wrote back in the when I was in Tucson. So probably like late 80s, early 90s. My poetry is not as narrative now as it was back then, but I'm still very much working with narrative and images. But I was definitely like I didn't realize it at first when I was working on this piece, but then once I had really gone into it and sort of I mean, like every poem has gone through many iterations, but somewhere along the way, I realized that there really was this like movement in the poem that I hadn't intended at all. But when I realized it was there, I was like, this is exactly right. A feeling like observational, sort of like on the outside of things, getting back to your earlier question, but much earlier, you know, and then moving from the outside, from not from margin to center, as they say, but from the outside to a much more inside position, and then everything disappeared.
Yeah, it's interesting. You have a PhD, and how does it change your writing? How does that change your ability to analyze, your ability to get this micro about the, you know, do you find that interrupts, or do you find it helps you as a poet?
There are people, and I know people who have done this, and I'm not one of them. You know, there are people who were in a PhD program and were able to keep writing poetry while they were in. And that's not me, you know. I mean, I just like literally stopped completely. I'm sure in certain ways that it has, like I was saying, my writing now is, like I still very much work with narrative, obviously, but I'm much more like this piece is very chronological. And the past present poem, which is the one piece that I like when Elena asked me to, for the manuscript, past present was the piece that I really needed to, half the poem is new, essentially. And I was really much more working. I mean, that poem, that was part of the intent of the poem, but also just in general, my work these days, there's like narrative blips, but they all sort of jumble up again or jump up, bump up against each other in different time strands. And whether or not that's an impact of doing a dissertation and a PhD in observational writing or not, I'm honestly not sure. But I will say this, my dissertation, I read a lot of like 17th century Scottish philosophy, John Locke and all those people. And they were incredible. There was like this mysticism about their work and the way they would just sort of go off on things that I think that probably has affected my, like the reading I was doing, I think has probably affected my work in certain ways, even though I wouldn't say the writing has.
Yeah, the
I
ring
see
was
what you're saying.
that's interesting. And then I'm just thinking about the different aspects of the book, just to let readers know. They can get this on various sites, online, past, present, and other poems of Robert Kaplan. And like past, present, I was noticing how, you know, there's like an individual page you highlight a passage. You know, poem goes on, and there's a highlight passage on individual page. You comment a little bit on the structure of the first poem.
Oh, you mean those pages where it's just like a few lines and italicized? Okay, so little known secret, that was Elena's suggestion actually, because she felt, and I think she's right, that I was because the poem jumps around so much in time, I was really trying, and I hope I was successful to have little anchors for the reader here and there, just to like know, like okay. This is the present. No, this is what now we're in one level of the past. Now we're in another. I mean, it keeps on bouncing back further and further into the past before it starts coming up to the present again. And she felt, and I think she's right, that there was important for the readers to have sort of like resting spots. And I was trying with that one refrain about where is it? About light. I'll find it in a moment. Here we go. Once light shortened, then grew long, then shortened, then again lengthened. Once the earth rotated a couple of times, completed its cycle again and then again. So I was trying to do that with the passage of time and the going back and forth from New York to Tucson. And I hope I was successful with that, but I think she was right. Even so, it's such a long poem. And unlike, say, Leaves of Grass, there's no like separate sections.
Oh, yeah.
And
Right,
that was intentional on my part because I really wanted the sense of like time and different time strands. It's the past and the present. And that's why there's a slash mark between past and present as opposed to a hyphen or a space, because they really meld into each other, I think.
yeah, interesting,
And
interesting.
so those spots were, so the reader could take a breath.
Yeah. They also highlighted a very beautiful, I think one of the most beautiful passages in the poem. Some of the most beautiful passages were highlighted that way and really gets you a sense to settle with that passage. As a reader, I felt like I settled with the passage a little more. And I appreciated that technique as well.
Oh, good. Thank you.
And I was just thinking, did you get a chance to see a little bit of the eclipse that just passed by?
I did. I even canceled class so we could all
Oh,
watch
yeah,
the
very cool.
eclipse.
Actually,
Yeah, glasses.
well, guys,
I'm sorry, was that?
Doug was saying something. Yeah,
Did you have those glasses?
Yes. Yes.
you
Yeah.
did. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah.
you have to
Yeah.
check the eyes.
I know exactly. I'm like walking around like this. Yeah. It was, I had two very different reactions to it because people, it kept on being hyped up. I mean, where we were was not totality, and I think that was, but it kept on being hyped up, and I kept on waiting. I was with some of my students, and we're sitting outside. We're like, "So where is it already?" But then when it finally happens, and you could really see the moon coming in front of the sun, the two things. Things that really struck me were, one is just how, like, that point where we didn't have totality, but the point where the moon was almost completely blocking out the, like, the sun looked like a crescent moon, only it was the sun, but it was still
Exactly, yeah,
light, but it was still light outside, and it just really struck me in a way I never had before, how powerful, how potent that sun must be, that just a little bit of it, and we could still, it was still daylight, definitely. But also, it's just like, I mean, obviously, we sit wherever we are and we look up at the sky and there's the moon or there's the sun and things like that. But just to see them like crossing like this, there was something so, it's a cliche. It's the best that can come up with otherworldly. It's like all these forces out there that I think are affecting us that we don't, aren't even aware of, and just how much is still out there that we can't comprehend.
Yeah, I
It
totally
just felt
agree.
like an opening of something of some kind.
I'm so glad to hear you say that because it's like some people are arguing about like how it's all taking a very scientific approach, and like the very kind of current tale, cut and dry scientific approach. Whereas I like it when we acknowledge the mystery and we acknowledge the otherworldliness of it in the sense that there's something mysterious about it, there's something ethereal about it that a science textbook will never be able to explain,
Exactly. And speaking of Tucson, one of the incredible things about being out there was, there's a big observatory not very far away, so they have really strict laws about, nighttime light pollution, and it's a little scary because it's dark, but because there aren't very many street lights except on the real major roads, you can see so much of the sky at night and the stars and the planets and everything. And talk about, like, there's the mystery, and it just like made me realize just how we. It's impossible not to get caught up in our own lives and everything feels so, but it's like we're just one tiny little blip in some huge, huge, universe. For all I know, I assume that there's life forms elsewhere because it would be totally egotistical to think that there's not. But sometimes I think, well, are we a failed experiment?
I
You know what
definitely
I
think
mean?
like the aliens came here and settled down here rather than us life burgeoning in Earth. You know, I definitely think like some other planet must have had their last survivors come here, and that's why we have history going back, you know, all this history
I think you're right. Yeah.
that
Yeah.
a lot of this history sounds like it's impossible for it to happen on this planet, you know,
Yeah.
something like that. So it definitely feels like they must have ancient history and otherworldly, you know.
I wouldn't surprise me in the least bit, but it's talking about history repeating itself. It's like they
Yeah.
figured escape something. It's like we're doing an awful job,
Yeah,
We
yeah.
really are. I mean, we're destroying the planet, we're destroying each other, and I don't want to sound all doom and gloom, but it just feels like we're an experiment that failed, or the people who got out from somewhere else, they're just repeating their own trauma all over again. No.
Yeah, definitely capitalism is something that seems like it's failing or failed. But I think like it's interesting. I want to circle back to your bio about the elder care. You mentioned a little bit about that. You talked a little bit about that, how like that's something that definitely is like not very good in our culture, how we treat, you know, those who are growing older or those who are, you know, kind of like not in the way, same wisdom tradition in all the cultures in the
I
Western
agree.
culture, you know. Talk a little bit about elder care, yeah.
Well, I agree with you a gazillion percent. There's two things I want to say about that. One of which is the most of the pe it's such a gender stereotype, but unfortunately, it's also true that most of the people who do elder cares are the daughters or the mothers. And there were so many times when I would be in the hospital with my father, or later on, I'd be in the hospital with my mom, and the nurse would come in, and the nurse would like look at me like I was a rarity,
Yeah,
because there really were
yeah.
very few. But I think it's not just elder care per se. I remember, and I'm sure I did this when I was younger too. I remember when I was in my early 30s in New York, and it suddenly hit me that there was a whole new generation of quote unquote kids, who had this their own culture that I was no longer part of, and I was sort of invisible to them. And I probably did the same thing when I was 22 to people who, don't trust anyone over 30 or something like that. But I just feel like there's so much age disposability in this, in our
Yeah,
culture.
I agree. Yeah.
And for me, during the elder care, it's like it wasn't even a choice. It was just like this was the relationship that I had with both of them. It's something one does out of love. And in a way, I mean, that's what we did back in the 80s with people who were dying of HIV. So it just
Oh,
sort
good
of,
point. Yeah. Yeah.
became ingrained. But I think there is such a disposability of age in this country.
Yeah. But as everyone listens to Ready for Brooklyn, the Truth to Power show, we're here with author and poet Robert Kaplan and Douglas Kalla. And I'm Bijar Nathan. Ready for Brooklyn survives based on your donations. So if you'd like to donate to Ready for Brooklyn, go to readyforbrooklyn.org/donate. Remember that you know, exciting conversations such as this and various kinds of ways you can enliven our conversations by donating to Ready for Brooklyn. So I didn't have the exact copy there, but basically the idea is that you know, Ready for Brooklyn is a community-driven radio. So yeah, talking to Robert Kaplan about past, present, his various poetry, his various writings. So one of the as we start to close, I just want to say like about community, we could talk a little bit about community and building. Community in Queens, and you know, I think Poets of Queens doing their own reading. I think it's coming Wednesday, so we can try to promote
Oh, are
that.
they really? Yeah, they have a
Yeah.
quiz for you. Yeah.
So
QED.
the Brooklyn Queens connection, but of course, if you're able to come out, I believe it's QED. Yeah. Yeah. So, and if you talk a little bit about, we can talk a little bit about community, in Queens and in the various boroughs. It's nice to have like the, I worked for 15 years, 20 years in the Queens Public Library. So going all around the different neighborhoods of Queens and their different flavors and how they So unique how they have immigrant populations, and New York City, we think of only Manhattan, but of course the outer boroughs have their own flavor too. Yeah,
Yes, very much so.
totally.
Yeah,
Yeah.
no.
But so what else? What else on your mind? I brought up a little bit of the current events, the O.J. Simpson, and the various ways in which we were talking about history repeating. This way in which we brought something sucked back to the controversies of the past, and how that exists and stuff like that. And what other stuff is coming up in the news? Anything else in your mind?
Well, this is sort of related, not quite, but the second anthology of Poets and Queens that'll be
Oh,
coming.
yeah.
Right. So I have a the piece that I have in that is a poem called Bound Park. And Bound Park is this park, it's a literal park, it's a block away from here. It's about 4 blocks long and 1 block wide, and it's about what it was like to be a kid in this neighborhood growing up and playing in Bound Park and falling in the pond and stuff like that. And then growing older and people moving away and people dying and coming back and just sort of like all the different layers of life. And it's something that hits me a lot also when I go back down to the East Village. It's like here too, a lot of the buildings on the exterior still look very much the way they did back in the old days, but the people, of course, are completely different.
Right, sure.
Yeah. So when I was growing up, this was really an Italian and Irish neighborhood, and we were the only Jews on the block until I was about 13 years old, and it was fine. It wasn't an issue at all. But now, of course, is over the last, I guess, 20, 30 years or so, there's been this big Asian, migration here. And I remember, it's terrible, but I remember this goes back now, probably a good 15 years or so, when some of the prior generation, the parents were still here. Like my mom, bless her heart, and my father too, they were real humanitarians. And my mom knew from her own, and my father was born here, but his parents barely got out with their life from Russia with pogroms. So they had a really different experience in terms of immigration. But there were some of the other old timers who would just state these derogatory things.
Oh.
And like I remember, but they themselves were immigrants, and it's like having to remind them that they were who these people are now.
Sure,
And
sure.
yeah, oh, so it really is very much to me like the same. There's a very much a repetition of politics that just seems to be repeating itself over and over again.
Yeah, it feels like those who read history understand or see that, but so many people don't understand because, especially with all these ways spun, they try to spin it like a way, oh, it's all new, it's all different. But like the point is, we see the patterns emerging, and like they seem so obvious to some people, and we're doomed to sit on the sidelines and be like, oh, it's happening again, you know? Yeah. But yeah, and especially with the kind of like the feelings of like being stalled out or not being able to influence. We're just caught in the sideline, and that feeling can be very disheartening. But at the same time, it can be somewhat, it can be very disheartening. But at the same time, we have to get beyond that and see how can we influence some way. Yeah, what do you think is the solution to this feeling of powerlessness? I mean, is there any ways you've dealt with that and feeling like where do we go from here, kind of thing with
Yeah, I
these world
know.
events? Yeah.
I'm not sure. I mean, in the naivete of my youth, I really thought being a poet would somehow transform the world. And now in my jaded old age, I realize like that's not the case.
But at the same time, at the same time, at least for yourself, having a more fulfilled life, and I don't mean to sound bubblish, isolationist, but the point is, if we're able to like make sense of it all, on some level or some degree, if we're able to make sense in our own head, oh, the world is a sensible, loving place,
Oh, I agree with that. But I keep thinking, and this is like something I've been asking myself a lot lately, in the limited amount of time I have, like what type of political work could I be doing again? Like what kind of like intervention, like where could I get myself involved? Because culture isn't enough.
Yeah.
And I think like the Celtic
Right.
culture,
Yeah.
it
Yeah.
was great. It was liberating. It
Yeah.
was incredible. And back in the 70s, and being in the East Village was incredible in the 80s, but culture isn't enough.
Yeah.
When there are power spots, and that requires political intervention, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting because like I'm going through the struggle myself, and I feel like for me at least, and this may be controversial to say, but I feel like Jesus out of all the gods or deities feels like he's the most like in your face about it, you know, like in your face throwing down the axe in regards to that. So I just feel like the movement around like social justice around, although you know, Christianity is having its putting that aside, just the figure of Jesus being like a social justice warrior. Has been very activated in me, like trying to go out there and like preach or whatever. But at the same time, it's like remembering that in your heart should be pure. Your heart should be purified and should not be like bitter or should not be like seeing the world as an evil place or as a disruptive place, but rather seeing it as a pure land. That's the only way you can move into these structures with pure intention. Otherwise, I feel like a poet's heart it should have, it should retain, you know, like not have like a malignant heart or something that wants to destroy, but rather something it wants to create, you know? Yeah. And what is a poet's heart for you? Like, what is the heart of the poet, you
The
know?
heart of the poet for me is transformation.
Oh, yeah.
Taking like the moments in time and weaving them together into something complete, into something that includes all of them and transcends them all at the same time.
Yeah.
So like in a sense, we're talking about different forms of transformation because politics is hopefully about transformation as well.
Yeah.
But I don't feel anymore that I do think poetry has a transformative quality too. I think good
Yeah.
poetry does. But I don't feel anymore like that's sufficient. And
Yeah.
I used to think that that was sufficient, and I no longer do. And
Yeah.
now that elder care is, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm kind of at this point in my life now where like, okay, so what do I want to do next? And the poetry is really wonderful. I do have a job that I intend to keep, but it feels like there's a certain amount of energy that I need to do into something else that's a different type of transformation.
Yeah, totally. I agree. It's funny because like not to plug myself, but like Breakdown Dancer is very much an investigation into my own past, and like which is published by Postings Press in December 2021, and then like investigating. I think like definitely going back to your own memories because really at the end of the day, that's what we're left with. You know, the ways in which how we become who we are now, and like going back to your own memories and being like, how can I revisit with the intentionality of becoming a better man, you know, becoming a better person. And then like ultimately moving forward with the feeling like where I've come from is enriching me and like, you know, bring me to a place where I want to go. So that's how I get out of that. And like inviting other people to like co-create themselves in that way, you know, in a way that is enriching themselves and moving forward. But you don't want to just be like tending to your own garden. Totally agree with that. I think we can be a warrior in a garden, you know, I think it was Lao Tzu who said that he's basically like being a warrior garden rather than a gardener in a war, meaning that once you tend to our own garden, we have to go out there and, you know, propagate the truth, if you will, or something along those lines.
Exactly. While you were talking, I was just thinking about oral cultures before. And the way how narrative and story were a way of passing on exactly what you were talking about passing on the truths of the culture so that people could then move forward.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. I the last five, we have like the last 4 or 5 minutes, but I was gonna say like I'm also like did the clinical mental health counseling track with the second masters and trying to get people to like continue their own storytelling in their own life is something very important to me as well. Like doing the kind of work we're doing as poets to promote that craft in other people, so that more and more people will write books like Past, Present, and you know, more and more people promote the idea of revisiting their histories and, you know, continue to be a tradition, an oral tradition they'll read and continue to write on, you know? Yeah.
Totally. Yep.
So hopefully this will be a movement rather than just a single, a single
Yeah,
effort.
like a one-off thing. Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. And for all of us to be inspired by these writings. Yeah. So just as we end, final words, we go around about, what we hope to see in the world, or what we hope, what a movement we want to see, and our final words, and we'll start to close up.
Well, okay, this probably doesn't quite address your question, but while you were talking, I was just thinking about the fact that everybody has stories, and part of the problem is that the stories conflict with each other. People don't want to hear each other's stories. So, and I think if people
True.
like heard each other's stories, then the world might be really a different place. Unfortunately, I don't think that's sufficient anymore. I mean, that's the poet in me thinking like, well, writing will change the world, and I just don't think that's sufficient anymore. But where I would hope the world could get to would be a place where people, going back to what we were saying before about othering each other, hearing each other's stories is a way to break through that othering.
Yeah, totally. I mean, if everyone were to sit down right now and start to write this story, there might be a lot of bitterness, there might be a lot of othering. But if we get to the process, the purification process, or some kind of process of like really revisiting those memories with a true heart, with the poet's
Yes,
heart, I think we might
exactly.
get to the point where rippling outward, more and more people will be able to write the intimacy, the kindness, the kind of poet's heart. Maybe, who knows? I just want to invigorate, spark a little joy in you that a poet's heart should be spread across the world, and hopefully
It
one
would
day
be,
we'll all be poets.
I mean, that's reconciliation in a way, like what you're talking about. Yeah. So you have to start a group of people with completely disparate political viewpoints who are willing to listen to each other through story.
Exactly. Yeah, thank you, thank you. And Doug,
Yeah.
any last words?
Yeah, no, I'm in agreement with everything you guys are saying. I mean, I think the arts, well, the arts in general, I think have their own set of have its own set of power to influence, people across generations, And I think whether it's poetry, whether it's visual art or photography or filmmaking or all of those crafts, kind of move the thought, like basically are able to make, thought-provoking statements and move the, and push the conversation forward. Like even if society is regressing, you still have these that can like push things forward,
Exactly. It's kind of like I was just thinking about that Parisian guy, Parisian father, who told his child, they have guns, but we have flowers, in the sense that, I don't know if you saw the video, but that's a very beautiful video. So they may have the Fox News, but we have poems, I don't know. Something like that. Like we have done the power of poetry in the long run, I think in the long run, talking about hundreds of years, is much more powerful than these blips on the TV, So I want to keep the faith
I agree, yeah.
that writing poetry is more long-standing than 100 years from now. I hope they'll be reading Robert Kaplan's Past, Present, and
I hope so too.
Thank you guys. Thank you so much for being here. The Truth About Show airs every Sunday at 7 a.m. But we'll have it archived in our radioforbrooklyn.org/truthpower. Thanks so much, guys.
Right. Thank you
All
so
right,
much.
awesome. All right,
Yeah.
take care. Yeah,
Okay.
great meeting you.
Bye.
All right, take
Have a
care.
good
All
one.
right, bye-bye.
Yeah. Take care. This is recording.